about that and break through walls of all things false and true. How about that? How about that?
Is supported by Roxbury General, a modern general store on Main Street in Roxbury, a source for gifts and necessities for all occasions, from unique pottery and jewelry to stationery and hardware. Open every day but Wednesday, 11 to 6. 607-326-6118 or roxburygeneral.com. WIOX is supported by Freshtown Marketplace in the heart of Margaretville. Open till 9, Monday through Saturday, Sunday till 8, with everything you'd expect in a supermarket, including local and organic foods, gourmet coffees, microbrew beers and ales, and online shopping. Learn more about online shopping at foodtown.com/shopping.
Hello, hello. Nicole Bomer here, host of Blue Show Something Old, Something Blue, every Wednesday night from 8 to 10, and classic rock show Smokin' Saturdays that happens alternate Saturday nights, also from 8 to 10. And you are listening to WIOX Roxbury, live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and WIOXRadio.org.
Okay, you're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local, in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20 and everywhere at WIOXRadio.org, where it's easy to donate. If you like what you hear, you can also get WIOX on any smart device through the FM radio apps. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good, Ryan. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine, John. You know, can't complain. We're at pruning apple trees still. We're going to say that how many more times? I don't know. Till the end of March.
Another five or six times on this show. So people are probably going to get pretty bored of us talking about pruning apple trees, since that's what last show was all about.
Yeah.
But I had the opportunity. Well, I put up new trail cameras at the new house I bought. So I had some cool opportunities to see the wildlife around. I have things to share.
Yeah.
I got two things to share. One, found my first trespasser on my property.
Good job.
He had a rifle, so we got to go figure out what he was up to.
Yeah, you don't want competition.
That's right. Yeah, I assume he was after my squirrels, but...
You want a monopoly on the wildlife.
Right, especially when you're as passionate about, you know, the outdoors and hunting as I am. So
right.
But more interesting is turkeys in full strut. It's a little early, But I knew it right away when I was checking the camera. I saw the tracks in the snow and the wing drag marks in the snow behind them. And I said, wow, those things are strutting.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah, so their wings fold down all the way down when they're strutting along. So, yeah, breeding season for them is April, May. So it's a little soon, but that's cool. There was 8 toms in the picture and no hens. So I don't know what he was thinking, but...
It's been warm. That's what he's thinking. Yesterday was beautiful. We're pruning apple trees down in Kerhonkson, Ulster County, and it was 55 degrees, and there's ants in my sap buckets.
Really? That's usually a March thing, right?
Yeah. There's ants are all around the spouts and stuff. I don't worry. I filter them out for those of you, well, those very few of you who actually eat the syrup that I give out. But, yeah, they get filtered out. Yeah. Freaks my daughter out.
Added flavor.
All those moths and stuff, yeah.
Added flavor.
Yeah, it's
that's where the maple flavor probably comes from. Yeah.
The ground is dry. you know, people like to guess at why the sap runs and doesn't run every year, and that's what keeps us going. But I think, this is my new theory, John, that we didn't get snow. And the old timers used to say if you don't get snow, the sap might not be as good. And they thought it had to do with cold. I really don't think it has to do with cold. Because you can make syrup, I believe, in North Carolina as long as the temperatures are okay. It freezes at night. It raises during the day. I don't see how that would affect sugar content. However, sap, there's going to be less of it if the ground is dry. And remember those 2 weeks in the beginning of January? It rained not too much. And we went through the mud season. It was like muddy, like you would expect in March. And then it started drying up. Now the ground's still wet for this time. You know, it's wet compared to like, you know, August or something. But it's drying up, man, because where I walk to get my buckets where there's a seep, a spring seep, it's like dry there. Yeah. So we haven't had the snow recharging it when you get the melting or anything. And the trees aren't drawing up. I mean, a day like yesterday, it was 48 degrees where I live. No, it was 55, actually. I would usually get 2 gallons of tap per tap, right? 2 gallons of sap per tap. Say that 3 times fast. I got, you know, maybe one, a little over one. And it was really warm, man.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, there's a seep that I have within the chicken run in the fence that waters my chickens throughout the winter. Yeah. I had to give them water this morning. It was completely dry. And there's no snow for them to peck at. So they had nothing to drink.
I know.
Felt bad for them.
Yeah, you felt bad.
So I actually just shoveled some snow to them because I had to go to work. But
you're a liar.
They got to drink that way. But
yeah,
yeah, no, it's dry. So maybe you have something to do that. I don't have any buckets out this year. I don't have the time right now, but maybe in March. We'll see.
We'll see. Anyway, we ain't talking about sap, and we're not talking about apple trees tonight. We're talking about wintergreen fern with SUNY Delhi's Jack Tessier or Tessier? How do you say your last
Tessier.
Name?
Tessier.
Tessier. Yeah. Gotcha. How you doing, Jack?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for the invitation.
All right. We didn't talk too much before the show, and I don't like to talk to guests before the show too much. You know why? Because then when we get on the air, we just look at each other and like, we already covered everything. That's boring, right? So why don't you, before you get into wintergreen ferns, I'll introduce you a little bit. So you're in the Department of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and right. Your areas of expertise are ecology, environment, teaching, and learning. And research is in ecology, ecophysiology, and natural history of plants, especially forest understory plants.
That's right.
How'd you get into this stuff?
So I think it starts way back when I was in Boy Scouts. You know, we would go out all the time, and we'd be camping and out in the woods and everything. And I liked it. Liked being outside, liked doing things out there. And then ended up going to college. I was going to be a bio teacher, high school bio teacher. But then I got interested in teaching college level. And when I did my master's, my major professor at the time said, well, why don't you look at what the understory plants are doing, why there's more here and not so much there. And I started doing stuff like that. And ever since then, it's been those forest understory plants that really perk my interest.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, what have you found out besides wintergreen ferns? Anything that surprised you or about understory plants? Especially pertaining to forest management, which we always talk about.
Yeah, right. You know, I tend to find places that have had a lot of cutting, maybe not as good a management as you guys would do. We tend to lose some of those understory plants. They get a lot of invasive shrubs, and they shade out the understory. So we kind of lose that if we get too much cutting going on. So good forest management, which is really important to me, that's important to the understory plants as well.
Yeah. No kidding. So what is a wintergreen fern? I mean, first of all, what's a fern? Let's define a fern.
Right. Well, a fern is a, they're plants that are older than a lot of the angiosperms that we see. So the flowering plants, which everybody's used to, you know, maple trees are flowering plants. Ferns are what they call pteridophytes. So they're a really old type of plant. Yeah. If you're familiar with fossil fuels, which I think everybody is, it's the old tree fern forests that when they died and didn't decompose, they got compressed through time and turned into the coal and the oil and the natural gas that we're unfortunately burning these days. So ferns used to be the dominant plants in the forests. And with the advent of the flowering plants, they kind of got diminutive, much smaller, and now they're mostly in the understory. There's still tree ferns in the tropics, but still not as much as the angiosperms that are out there.
Yeah, giant horsetails, right? Is that
so to speak?
Long time ago, that's what I was taught anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
Why'd they go away?
Well, the angiosperms became a dominant type of plant on the planet. They're better at reproducing because they make seeds and they can protect those seeds, and they put fruits around those seeds so that there's better dispersal and whatnot. And they just became, you know, the dominant plants out there.
Things that make seeds, are they more genetically diverse or not
than the ferns?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, because some plants, you know, there's male plants and female plants. I don't know. How do they reproduce ferns then?
So ferns produce spores. So the part of the plant that we see most of the time with the big fronds, they're going to produce spores either on the back of the frond or on a separate stalk. And those spores will go out and land, and they'll make a gymnosperm, a little tiny heart-shaped thing. And there's sperm and egg that develop on those. And when they get fertilized, that grows a new sporophyte.
Okay, so they do reproduce sexually.
They still do sexual reproduction, yep, but they don't make seeds.
All right, gotcha. Yeah. See, I don't know anything about ferns. I really don't. John, did you know that?
Yeah, I did know that. Right, I couldn't explain it that well, but I've learned that many times in all the biology classes I've taken.
Hey, before we move on to the wintergreen ferns, what about maidenhair fern? It's one of my favorites.
Maidenhair fern is a beautiful fern.
Yeah.
Yep. We tend to see it in our area where there's a lot of calcium in the bedrock. Yeah. So it's what we call a calcophile. So maidenhair fern, Christmas fern, these are ones that tend to prefer a little bit more base-rich soil, as opposed to the acidic soils that we tend to see in most of the Catskills.
Yeah. Yeah, some places we find them, right, John?
You find them alongside ginseng indicator, right?
You got to give away everything, don't you?
We've had shows on ginseng, so our followers should
know. Who's listening?
Right, who's listening?
All right. So wintergreen ferns. Who are these guys?
Right, so by wintergreen, we don't mean that they taste like lifesavers, right? That's not what it is. Wintergreen means a type of leaf habit. So by leaf habit, I mean, when do the leaves develop? How long do they live? And when do they senesce? So I think the type of leaf habit that most people are familiar with is deciduous. So you think about maple trees, right? They make leaves in the springtime, they keep them all summer, and in the fall they drop off. So that's deciduous. A lot of people are also familiar with evergreen. So evergreen things are like white pines or spruces. They have leaves that live for multiple years, and the plant always has green leaves on it. Wintergreen is kind of in between there. They make a new set of leaves in the spring. They keep those leaves for the summer and then the fall and even through the winter. And then the next spring, a new set of fronds will come up, and that's when the old fronds will senesce. So they're basically keeping a set of leaves for about 1 year, putting them kind of in between deciduous and evergreen species.
Okay, so they're photosynthesizing throughout the winter then. That's the point. That's the purpose of being green, right?
Yeah, they can.
Through the winter.
If it warms up.
If it's warm enough, they can photosynthesize in the winter, yeah. And in fact, that's kind of the big advantage to being wintergreen in a deciduous forest, because most of the summertime when we think, oh, that's when plants are doing photosynthesis, they're in the shade. And if you don't get sunlight, you're not photosynthesizing very fast. So in the fall and then in the spring again, when it's warm enough but there's no canopy leaves out, these ferns have this big opportunity, and they make use of it. They do a lot of photosynthesis in the fall and the spring.
Mm. Yeah, gotcha.
And they are, can they do it at 30 degrees? Can they photosynthesize or no?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You might hear me say that quite a bit tonight, because there's a lot of things I don't know. And I think that's what's exciting about science, right? Because there's so much we don't know. people say, you know, you get a bachelor's degree, you think you know everything, but nope. There's a lot we don't know. And there's so much more to discover about these things. How does temperature affect their photosynthesis? If I had to guess, it'd be like any other chemical reaction. You know, the warmer it is, the faster they can photosynthesize, and probably somewhere around freezing is where you can't move water around anymore and they would have to stop. But I'm going to write that down because that's another research project we need to do.
Yeah, so, you know, let's define photosynthesis for our audience, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, you need, what do you need?
Yeah, so make it work. Photosynthesis, you need carbon dioxide that comes out of the air, you need water that plants generally get out of the soil, and you need sunlight. So if you can get sunlight to provide the energy, then the plants have chemical machinery inside their cells that combine the carbon dioxide in the water to make a carbohydrate, and that becomes the food.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. I mean, last night my daughter, Maple, was asking about how do you make syrup, and I was explaining to her. And I was like, well, she's like, how do you make sap? I was like, I don't make sap. The trees make the sap. Yeah. She's like, how do they do it? I'm like, I don't know. Photosynthesis. It's an amazing process, you know.
It is. We still cannot fully replicate it in a lab, so we are, as a species, we are totally dependent on plants for all of our food.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
Amazing.
I mean, they store carbohydrates in their sap. It's amazing, you know, from summer, and I don't know.
Right.
So what about grass? Maybe you know this. I know that you're like, grass. I'm talking about ferns, but I got to talk about grass for a second.
Okay.
When it warms up, especially if there's snow, I've noticed the grass seems like it's turning brown now there's no snow. But when there was snow, remember, you'd see green grass coming out whenever it poked out.
Yep.
Are they photosynthesizing if they're green? It must be, right?
They possibly can, yeah, as long as it's warm enough.
Did you talk to a grass guy? Is a grass guy studying wintergreen grass?
grasses are kind of an evergreen. They're green as long as there's enough to keep them warm. So they're ready to go in the spring already.
There's the grass in that spring seep that's feeding my chickens the water.
Sure.
That's green and growing. I've noticed it since in the 2.5 weeks I've been at the house that it's...
You should mess with people and get your weed whacker out.
I should get the lawnmower out.
What is that? What do I hear?
My neighbor, he'd love that.
So before we move more into ferns, how does this different than club moss? Because I get asked about it all the time, or Lycopodium.
Okay. Yeah, so the club mosses they're also pteridophytes. They're grouped taxonomically with the ferns. But the club mosses don't develop a leaf the way a fern does. They stay, their leaves are small and they're very close to the stem. Some of them are flat right down to the stem. So they kind of look like a cypress because the leaves are flat. And others, the leaves stick out looking like little pine trees, like princess pine is a common name for one of them. And it looks like a little pine tree. And so those are club mosses, and they're protected because what would happen is if you grab one, they're connected underground. So you could just grab one, pull them up, and people would turn them into wreaths and stuff for Christmas time. And that would obviously decimate the population if everybody was allowed to do that. So they're protected that way.
Well, maybe somewhere, but here, it's lucky we can get someone to cut the grass. People are actually taking this up and making wreaths out of them?
They used to until it was protected. So don't do it.
Right? All right. Okay, noted. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Wintergreen Fern with SUNY Delhi's Jack Tessier. So what are the names of some of these wintergreen ferns again?
Yeah. So the ones that people will see in our area most commonly are the common wood fern, and that's just everywhere. It's a very lacy-looking fern. It's big. It's a foot or so in its blades. We also have a closely related species, the marginal wood fern. It's in the same genus as common wood fern, but it's not as lacy in appearance. The subleaflets are more roundish. And if you turn those over, you'll see sori where they make the spores, and they're right on the margins of the leaflets. That's why it's called marginal wood fern. And the other one that we have quite a bit of in the Catskills is Christmas fern. And Christmas fern is a much darker green than the two wood ferns, and its leaflet looks like a Christmas stocking, hence it gets that name. So it's pretty easy to identify if you see it out there. And then there's a couple of others that we have in New York State, but one only grows in wet forests, and the other one is up on rocks and cliffs and stuff. So the ones that most people would see walking around in the woods are common wood fern, marginal wood fern, and the Christmas fern.
So I got to ask you, do you know anything about deer browsing wood ferns?
Yeah, the one that I've seen deer browse the most is that marginal wood fern.
Me too.
And it also has, its leaves are thick relative to the other two. And it could just be that it's much tastier. I have no idea, though.
I couldn't tell you either, but I hunt the same mountain on the same week every year and typically the same range of elevations. And where I'm at, between 2,600 and 3,300 feet in elevation, that's all the deer are eating. That's all I can find there. And they're digging, if there's snow, they're digging for it.
Right.
So at that time of year, I don't know if it sustains them through the winter, but at that time of year, that they're all over it. And I've always wondered why.
Yeah.
If there's anything, maybe because they're heavily photosynthesizing in the fall, maybe there's a buildup of energy in that frond that they're feeding on that's helpful to them. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that a fern frond, as much phytochemicals that has in it, is much tastier than a twig. So I'm sure.
Right, it's not a woody browse, right?
Yeah, I'm thinking that's a better option for them at that point. Right?
Okay. Well, there's another study for you.
There you go.
Because in third week in November, they're hammering that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. And actually, people talk about deer not wanting to eat ferns, but I was camping one time and I was in the tent during the day and I heard something walking around and it was like the same noise I'd hear at night. And you think, I know it's a bear and it's going to kill me. But I said, all right, I got to see what this is. So I opened the tent flap and there's a deer chewing on ferns. It's like, well, they do eat ferns.
What kind of ferns were they eating then?
Those were hay-scented ferns.
Yeah.
Man, yep, he's starving. Crazy. Yep. He's dumpster diving. Yeah. Hey, we've seen him eat spruce.
Sure.
Very rare. One instance. But we have seen it.
Yeah, but they were browsing that heavily, down to almost the size of our pinky in diameter. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That was crazy. Yeah.
That was some starving deer for sure.
Those were starving deer. I wanted to ask you, sweet ferns. Are they true ferns, or are they just, is that a misnomer?
What kind of fern
sweet,
is that?
Sweet fern, do you know that one?
Sweet fern?
Yeah, they grow in fire areas. I pick them, you put them in, you can make a tea out of them. They're really cool.
Is that,
You would find them in places where oak, hickory, chestnut grow, mountain laurel. They're all over the place on the Shawanuk Ridge where I grew up.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that common name, so
yeah.
I do not know.
Okay. All right. That's number two now.
Right.
Our whole goal here is constantly try to get you to say, I don't know something.
Excellent. You're doing great work.
No problem.
Nah, the more you learn about any topic, the more you think you know, the more you realize you don't know.
Oh, absolutely. Right.
You know, forests in general, it goes on and on.
Totally.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like photosynthesis, we look at trees every day, we don't even know how they do anything. You know?
Right.
Amazing.
Yeah, we can't replicate the photosynthesis in a lab.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Wintergreen Fern with SUNY Delhi's Jack Tessier. So what stuck out to me when I was reading through some of the stuff you sent me about Wintergreen Fern was that this plant has invested in an ability to hinge over under the snow and stay alive, waiting for the snow to melt so it can be there in a crumpled mess. And to somehow reallocate, some of its chemistry or nutrients or whatever to the future fronds or leaves. Why would it do this? Amazing.
Well, it's taking advantage of an opportunity where resources are available. And it was other researchers that identified this hinge and how it works. But basically, if you imagine a big pretzel stick, right? And instead of it being solid pretzel, imagine the inside is peanut butter and not the kind of crumbly peanut butter that's inside of, pretzel peanut butter bites, but a nice, soft, flexible peanut butter, right? So that solid pretzel stick with its soft peanut butter is the upright frond. And the main part of the rachis or that stem on the fern is the pretzel. And inside of that peanut butter is the xylem and phloem, so the vascular tissue that moves sugars and water and nutrients up and down for the fern to use. So what happens is basically if you were to drop some water on that pretzel and get it nice and soft, it's just going to flop over. but that peanut butter will stay intact. Mm-hmm. So that's what these ferns are able to do. They can soften up the outer part of that rachis or the stem and let the frond just fall down and go flat to the ground during wintertime. And that vascular tissue, the xylem and phloem, stays intact. So it can move things around functionally, yet be flat to the ground. And that allows it to bring on a blanket of snow in the wintertime and keep it warm so that in the spring, that frond looks perfect. It's nice and green. It's ready to photosynthesize. And in some species, they're moving carbon back to the rest of the plant. In some species, they're moving nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus back to the plant from that frond. Not all of them, but some of them. So it's maintaining that that peanut butter layer. It allows them to stay functional during the fall, winter, spring, whenever they can photosynthesize.
Now it's February 5th, and everything's melted for the most part in the Catskill right. Mountains. What's going on with the ferns now?
They're hoping for snow. Because if they get really cold weather, they'll get frosted. And just like any plant, if it gets frosted too hard, it's going to turn brown. It's not going to be able to photosynthesize. And basically, its effort to try to keep those fronds through the winter is a wasted effort. So yeah. Spring will come around, and if they've gotten too much damage, they won't be able to do as much photosynthesis as they had planned on doing, basically. Right.
Okay, so that subniving layer is good for, we do a winter show sometimes too.
It's a great word.
So that subniving layer isn't just for the small mammals underneath, it's for the...
Any way you can fit that word in, huh?
That's right.
Unreal.
Right, it protects the fronds, it's going to protect the club mosses as well.
Yeah.
It keeps them from getting frosted and losing that photosynthetic surface in the wintertime.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. The forecast isn't looking that snowy.
Maybe a couple inches tonight, and that's all I see.
Oh, yeah?
And then it's going to warm right up tomorrow and rain, so we're going to lose it.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Right.
Huh. Well, on that note, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., and tonight's topic is wintergreen ferns with SUNY Delhi's Jack Tessier. Up next, we're going to go into a few of the studies that Jack has been up to and see what's going on there. Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is wintergreen ferns with SUNY Delhi's Jack Tessier. So I was looking over your studies that you sent me, and leaf habit, phenology, and longevity of 11 forest understory species. This is one study you did?
Yeah, so quite a few. There were three evergreen species. There's partridgeberry, gold thread, and rock polypody. The wintergreen species were the three that we've already talked about, those three wintergreen ferns. I looked at also a seasonal green species, a common wood sorrel, which we have here, and then a couple of deciduous, red trillium and roundleaf violet. And then there were two spring ephemerals, which grow in the Catskills too. There's spring beauty and trout lily. So this study was actually done when I was working in Connecticut, and I was up at Algonquin State Forest in the northwest part of the state near Winsted. So the climate there is actually somewhat similar to the Catskills because it was a higher elevation. So, you know, we have all these species that were showing up there too.
What do you think, John?
Did anything surprise you in that study? What were the outliers?
Yeah, well, you know, I chose those species because I wanted to have a nice replication within all those different categories. And they didn't all match up identically to each other, even though they were in the same category. And I think as humans, we tend to categorize things because that makes us feel more comfortable. You know, this is an American car and that's a Japanese car. And this is person's that race and that's person's that race. And this is deciduous and that's evergreen. But things aren't always neat in those baskets. You know, there's American cars that have an awful lot of Japanese parts. And we're, you know, we're always trying to train ourselves to be anti-racist. So we're not thinking about groups of people like that. And I think we have to start thinking in a way like that with the plant species, because even with those, within those wintergreen ferns, the Christmas fern was keeping its fronds longer than the two wood ferns, the common wood fern and the marginal wood fern. So they would all make their fronds in spring, but then the Christmas fern would hang on to its fronds even toward fall. So it was getting a lot more overlap between the 2 years of fronds than the other wintergreen species. Likewise, in the spring ephemerals, trout lily would hang on to its leaves longer than the spring beauty every time. So I did this for 3 years. Yeah. And if you're familiar with spring beauty and trout lily has a much bigger, thicker leaf. And that gets at the idea of construction costs. So how much does it cost to build a leaf like that? If it costs more, well, you better hang on to it longer so you get more use out of it. And right. Generally within these species, with the exception of the two much smaller ones, the partridgeberry and the gold thread, the bigger the leaf was, the longer it stayed on the plant on average. So that seemed to be a theme throughout all of the different categories, even with all the variability within the categories.
Trout lily, now that you mentioned it.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about any nutrients that might be in that? Because I used to eat the hell out of trout lilies.
Yeah.
I still pick them on the trail all the time.
Yep.
It tastes really good.
They do a similar thing to what the wintergreen ferns do, is they're trying to take advantage of that short period of light when the snow has melted but the canopy leaves aren't out yet. Yeah. So they will photosynthesize like crazy in the spring, make as much sugar as they can, and then send it down to the corm, the little storage organ that's going to be below ground the whole rest of the year. Right? Imagine that. You get to eat for about a month and a half, and you're done for the year. Yeah. That's tough.
So you want to eat them in the spring when they're fully photosynthesized before they send it down below, is what you're saying here. I'm not... You know, I'm trying to feed myself.
Yeah, you're foraging. That's the time to do it, right? They make these droppers. It's a white, thick thread-like thing that comes off the bottom of the old corm, and it goes down and it makes a new one at a different spot. And I was out with students one time before I knew for sure what these things were, and a student picked it up and said, "What is this? Can I eat it?" And started eating it before I could say, "Wait!" But she said, "Oh, it's really sweet." I'm like, "Are you okay?" Yeah, she's okay. So, yeah.
Okay.
So
what were you going to say to her?
Well, you shouldn't have eaten.
You should have been like, ah, never mind.
Right. Yeah, you got to tell people. Sometimes the effects don't show up for 2 weeks, so yeah. We don't know yet.
Should be fine. It'll
freak them out for a couple weeks.
Right. So, yeah, they move a lot of sugar from that leaf down into the new corm. So.
Yeah, they're definitely sweet.
Yep.
Definitely sweet.
And wildlife will eat those, too. You know, bears will dig them up. There's a related species out west, the glacier lily. And grizzlies will dig those up and eat the corms because they're bigger than our trout lily we have here.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, it's amazing a grizzly bear would gain weight off trout lilies or glacier lilies.
Glacier lilies.
Okay.
Yep.
Amazing.
Same genus. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I was out in Yellowstone in May, and we got to watch grizzlies eating. Personally, not eating people, but they were just foraging. Yeah. And we watched them for a good half an hour or more, and their nose was in the ground the whole time. They would dig and eat and dig and eat and dig and eat and just go into town on those things. Yeah.
How close were you?
We were pretty close. The closest group, we were probably 20, 30 meters. It was close.
How many yards is that?
A little less, yeah. So,
you college professor guys always talking to meters. I read these studies. I'm like, what is this?
Yeah,
feet,
sorry.
Yards.
We work in inches. Meters in ecology, and you guys work in yards or chains, or you know. Yeah. But yeah, so you know, 25 right. yards.
All right, like 25 yards.
Yeah, they were.
That's
close,
man.
We were on
man.
A roadway, and
that's
they
close.
Were down in a pasture, like not a pasture, but a little open area, and they're just digging around, eating stuff. And
were you in your Were you in your car?
We were with a group, and we had bear spray with us, and we could have readily gotten back on the bus if we needed to.
Ah, okay, good. All right. Yeah, you never know. Yeah. All right. So then there's this other study, vernal nitrogen and phosphorus retention by forest understory vegetation and microbes. And I guess you were comparing soil microbes to understory plants like ferns, right? Is that it?
Yep.
What's a microbe, first of all?
Yeah, so
let's define what that is.
Right. Microbes are the small living things that are in soil. So these are bacteria and fungi. Some of the fungi are actually connected to the plants, and others are free living. But basically, they're doing like any other living thing. They're trying to take up resources out of the soil so they can use it to do their life functions. And there were researchers in Michigan that had looked at soil microbes there, and they found that they were taking up quite a bit of nutrients in the springtime. So they could help with retaining nutrients in the ecosystem. And back in the 70s, researchers up at Hubbard Brook in New Hampshire had documented that the trout lily we were just talking about, because it's active in the spring, it can take up a bunch of nutrients at that time too. And they coined this term the vernal dam, that in the springtime, they hold up a bunch of nutrients and therefore it doesn't get lost from the ecosystem.
Okay.
So combining those two ideas that plants and microbes can do this, I thought, well, let's look at the same time at not just spring ephemerals, but all kinds of understory plants that are green in the spring and maybe could be taking up nutrients. So that was what the project was about. We took soil samples, we took plant samples throughout the spring and documented the change in what you call the nutrient pool, that is how much nutrients are being held onto at that time. And there's that change through time. And there was variability in the plants. There was 1 year where they didn't really take up much, and then 2 years where they took up a fair bit of nutrients. In fact, they were pulling up more nutrients than were lost in the stream during spring. Whereas the soil microbes, where we were in the Catskills outside of Frost Valley, they had a big pool, but the pool size didn't change. So they weren't taking up nutrients any more than they were losing them. So at least in those years in that forest, those plants, the common wood fern, shining club moss, common wood sorrel, and maple seedlings, they were taking up more nutrients than the soil microbes were.
Okay.
Yeah. And the concern there is that in the springtime, you get snow melt, you get soil warming, there's nitrification going on, so nitrogen is becoming mobile on the soil, and it can run down into the streams and basically get lost from the ecosystem. So if you lose nitrogen from an ecosystem, that's a loss of a resource for the plants. On the other end of it, if you get a bunch of those nutrients going into the water, now you have low drinking water quality. So you have to think about that in two different ways. So in this case, those understory plants are serving to protect water quality and keep resources in the forest for the rest of the ecosystem.
Another a side question here. How long do these wintergreen ferns usually live for?
I don't know.
Yeah, right.
If you if you're to dig one up,
pull that one out of my hat. Right,
yeah,
here.
It's a good one. The common wood fern. What you'll see is a rhizome that has all these little, looks like stalks sticking out of it, and basically that's where the old fronds were attached. Yeah. And where they stop is where that hinge was, and the rest of the thing senesced, decomposed, and it's part of the soil now. But where it's attached to the rhizome, you could count a ring, and that's 1 year of growth. What'll happen, though, is on the back end of that rhizome, it's getting older and older, and it's senescing and going away. But if you can dig those up, you could generally count 5 to 8 years worth of old stalks on there, well, and you have no idea how many more were there beforehand and are gone.
Yeah.
So I would easily say they could live decade, 2 decades, but I don't know if anybody does know exactly how long a single plant, single fern grows.
Yeah, I was wondering. You know, because I'm thinking about ginseng, like you were saying before, John. Ginseng's kind of a weird plant because it's one of the few understory plants that can live over 50 years old.
Oh, yeah. Some of these definitely can. Trillium can live that long.
Oh, yeah. Trillium can too, huh?
Sure. You can kind of count rings on the trillium rhizome.
Amazing.
To look at years of growth as well.
Wow.
Yeah, these plants can live for decades. Probably not as long as trees, but they can live a long time.
Now, to my knowledge, ginseng can go dormant for a couple of years if the conditions aren't right for it to grow. Do you know if these other plants can do the same?
There are definitely other understory plants that do that. There is an orchid that you'll see in a spot 1 year, and then not for years, and then the next year, oh, there it is, it's up again. It's one of the round leaf orchises, and I have no idea why it's there some years and why it isn't others.
Yeah, lady slipper, maybe.
Lady slipper, I'm not aware of that not coming up each year, because usually if you go to a place where there's that pink lady slipper, you'll see it every year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where are you seeing pink lady slippers, John?
Am I not allowed to say? No. My mother's property in Delancey has a lot of them. I don't know. And our board president of Gansko Forest Association.
He has some?
His property's got some.
Really?
Really.
Okay. I didn't know that. So I'll be there this spring. I'm just kidding. That was easy. Anything else you want to ask, John? Routing numbers? Count information.
Right. I'm talkative tonight.
Yeah, sure. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is wintergreen ferns with SUNY Delhi's Jack Tessier. We only have about 13 minutes left or so, so we got to ask you some more questions here. This study, reestablishment of three herbaceous understory species following fine-scale disturbances in a Catskill northern hardwood forest. I guess first to define the terms, what is a fine-scale disturbance?
Yeah, so for the purposes of that study, fine-scale was basically a meter square, and that stems from the previous project we were talking about where I was collecting plants to see how much nutrients they were holding on to. Well, when you do that, you have to take the plants out. So we had an opportunity there to look at how they reestablished in those places. So a fine-scale disturbance like that could happen with a tree tip-up, or animals digging for food and pulling things out of there, like bears will dig, turkeys will dig, that kind of thing. Anything that would cause a smaller disturbance like that. Not a situation where maybe you've done a clear cut and taken out the whole forest, but something smaller that happens fairly routinely in forests. So it's, you know, smaller, meter square, that kind of a size.
Okay. And what'd you find? What established, reestablished? What were some patterns you found?
Yeah, so basically the plants that came in were the ones that were there to begin with. So they were correlated with their abundance outside that area that had been disturbed. And the biggest plant was the common wood fern, and it would bring in a lot of cover. But in those cases where up to 3 years after the disturbance happened, the cover that it was establishing was all from plants outside that square meter. So basically it was arching into this opportunity to access soil resources and light. The one plant that came back and grew in those areas was the common wood sorrel, and it loved it. Its abundance was above what it was outside those disturbed areas. So it is It's the shortest of those three species that I was really concentrating on, the common wood fern, the shining club moss, and the wood sorrel. So it had an opportunity. A lot of times we tend to think of disturbance as a bad thing, but a disturbance creates opportunity for some species. In fact, there are whole ecosystems that are dependent on repeated disturbances, whether it's fire or waves like in sand dunes. In this case, the common wood sorrel was happy to have that opportunity to grow into those spots. And if you look at the abundance of those species spatially, they were negatively correlated with each other. So if you had common wood fern, you'd have less of the wood sorrel. And if you had more wood sorrel, you'd have less of the wood fern. Mm. So by creating that opportunity, you've brought in a space where the wood sorrel was happy, and the different plants would be growing in different spots in that forest.
Do you think those findings would extrapolate to a larger scale disturbance? Like, name anything, a natural... you know, straight line winds blowing up a whole section of forest or something like that?
Yeah, it depends on how big that disturbance is, because all those three species are really shade adapted. And if the disturbance is big enough that you take out too much canopy, now you get a whole lot of light showing up. Mm-hmm. And that means a whole other suite of species are going to take advantage of that disturbance.
Right.
So maybe bracken fern or hay-scented fern, any of those kinds of things. Tree species even that need a bigger disturbance, like the paper birch or something like that, that would come in. If it's big enough, those common understory species aren't going to be happy because they've lost their shaded habitat.
Gotcha.
We usually like to ask this of any guest, but how would you define quality habitat? I saw it in one of your studies, and I always want to know, what does that person mean by that?
Yeah, so good quality habitat depends on who you are. So some species would consider a shaded understory to be a nice habitat. I do, because I'm a shade worshiper. Other species wouldn't like that. So to a hay-scented fern, a clear cut, a tornado path, a burned area from fire, that's good habitat. You have opening, you have a lot of light, you have cleared soil, you're ready to go. But if you're common wood fern or trillium, that's not good habitat, because you're going to get bleached out from the sun and you can't take that kind of intense sunlight. So it all depends on who you are, what good habitat is.
Right? Makes sense. John, are you a shade guy or sun guy? Somewhere in between.
Depends on the day, I guess.
Oh, my God. It depends.
How about you?
Me?
Yeah. See, it's a tough question. Oh, yeah. Now you're thinking of scenarios, right? Like, well, it depends.
And these days, I'm mostly a sun guy in the woods because we have plenty of shaded forests. And I'm hungry usually, so most things that are edible, John, need light. There. Yeah. So there you go. I just spent the whole day pruning apple trees. It's all about light, man.
Yep. Yeah, we recommended one tree get cut to improve a fruit tree near it.
I know. Spruce tree, shading out that apple tree. Don't plant a spruce tree next to an apple tree. It just doesn't work out.
Right. Too much shade.
Too much shade. They don't belong next to each other. But, okay, so the next study is reduced winter snowfall and how it damages or doesn't damage the structure and functions of wintergreen ferns. This is kind of, accurate to what's going on right now.
For sure. Yeah, we've had a winter without too much snow, and we talked about this a little bit before, but snow is basically an insulating layer. It has a pretty good R value. That's why igloos work, right? You can build an igloo, go inside, it's nice and warm. So these ferns need that insulating layer so they don't get frost damage in the winter. So it's a little bit counterintuitive that if it's cold enough to keep snow around, the ferns are actually warmer. And it's winters where it's too warm and we don't get a snowpack developing that they get cold when we do have cold stretches. Yeah. So in this study, there just happened to be 2 years neighboring each other that one didn't have much snow and one had a normal snowpack, and very big differences in the amount of damage that those fronds experienced because of that lack of insulating layer of snow.
Last year had snow. Did we have snow last year, Jen?
I believe we did, but we did for a while, more than this year. But hey, February just started, and there's a lot of winter left.
That's right. Everyone, yeah, exactly.
2 years ago is when we didn't have hardly any snow until February, and then once it started, it just never stopped.
You know why we got no snow? Because I bought a brand new shovel.
this year.
I'm serious. The last time I bought a brand new shovel was about 2012. I moved to our new house. Didn't get any snow. Felt like I wasted my money, you know? Well, I ended up using it afterwards, in the next years afterwards. But that's why. That's it. That's the reason.
Oh, same thing. I just put a plow on the Jeep. I've only used it once.
There you go. Yeah. It's like when I got a generator. The power didn't go out for like 3 years. And now it does, of course, every time the wind even thinks about blowing. But yeah, so that's the way it goes.
So you should let the weatherman know if you've bought a snow shovel or not so they can predict better.
Right.
I'll email him. So, okay, we have about 6 minutes left. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is Wintergreen Ferns with SUNY Delhi's Jack Tessier. So the next study is potential influence of salamanders in coarse woody debris. We are especially interested in any study pertaining to coarse woody debris since John and I put a lot of coarse woody debris on the ground for wildlife habitat goals that we manage for. So Excellent. Tell me about this study.
Yeah, so you know what coarse woody debris is. It's large diameter trees that are on the ground, basically. And in a forest that's not being managed, that's because the tree dies. It falls over and it goes to the ground. And actually, a friend of mine from grad school, Greg McGee, documented that you get more common wood fern in areas where there's coarse woody debris. And we were walking around out in the woods one day, like I do a lot, and one of the things I thought about was, well, there's salamanders around these things all the time, too, because they hang out underneath them or on them. So I got to thinking, is it just that that those pieces of coarse woody debris add moisture to the soil? Or is it that they're actually getting their spores moved to these pieces of coarse woody debris by the salamanders that associate with them? So I had a couple students helping out with this one. So we got to go out in the woods and find a bunch of salamanders, and we rinsed them off to see if there was spores stuck to their skin, and we made a little track for them and had them walk across the back of a fern where the spores are and across a little microscope slide with Vaseline on it to see if their feet were picking up spores. And that idea came from a paper that showed that snails can move moss spores. They did the same kind of thing. So we looked at those two ways, and we found that we got gametophytes growing out of the soil where we rinsed those salamanders, so their bodies are holding spores. And in the Vaseline on the microscope slides, we found spores in pieces of the sori, that is the structures that hold the spores. So the salamanders can move these things in both ways. So it seems like they're good vectors or ways of distributing the spores out in the woods. And then we also, just to document the soil moisture part of it, we took soil samples from background areas in the woods and then also from right by the coarse woody debris. And obviously there's a lot more moisture around the coarse woody debris. So what we're thinking is going on is that the salamanders can move the spores to the coarse woody debris, and then the coarse woody debris provides lots of moisture, which spores need to germinate and the gametophytes need to persist and then grow new sporophytes. So if you're out in the woods, keep an eye on where the common wood fern's growing. And a lot of times you'll see it right with the coarse woody debris. And maybe those little salamanders have a role to play in that.
No kidding. Who would have thought salamanders are spreading plants out there, huh, John?
And? Those big bucks I'm chasing are feeding on the wood fern. So, no, I'm just kidding.
Is that what you're thinking?
I'm correlating where I see it. No, I'm just kidding. I'm saying maybe the big buck is near the coarse woody debris, not for the cover that's there, but for the wood fern food source provided by that salamander.
So what you're saying is
salamanders
cut are trees key. Down, salamanders come in, they spread wood fern, bucks feed on wood fern, you get a backstrap.
So I like salamanders.
All right. We're in.
Roundabout way of thinking. I'm just kidding around, but that's pretty neat.
Do be careful with the orange ones, the red F stage of the eastern newt. They're poisonous. So if you pick them up and want to look at them, wash before you eat. Our friend's cat actually died when it was trying to eat one of those red F salamanders.
The red F is poisonous?
It's poisonous.
They have a relationship with garter snakes. Garter snakes have a tolerance to them, and they kind of co-evolved together, and one became more tolerant, the other became more potent.
But you can handle them, right?
You can handle them. It's not going to go through your skin, but then wash your hands before you eat anything. And if you do handle the salamanders, put some water on your skin, because to them, our skin feels like sandpaper.
Yeah.
And that's not a nice thing for them to be feeling.
Because kids pick them up all the time, man. My kids love those things.
They do.
They think it's the coolest thing ever, Red Eft.
Yep. And they're all over the place. There's tons of them.
Everywhere.
Yep.
Yeah, I like them. They're cool guys.
They're pretty.
Now, they're not a salad. Why are they called Red Eft? Do you know?
The Red Eft is the juvenile stage of the newt. So the juvenile newt is aquatic. So they start out in the water. When they become basically teenagers, they go into the woods as the Red Eft, the orange, bright, shiny ones. And then as adults, they turn green again. They get a keeled tail, and they move back to the water. So they become aquatic again as adults.
And we have about 1 minute left on From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Wintergreen Fern with SUNY Delhi's Jack Tessier. Jack, what are you up to next?
So I've got a study now looking at what happens if you intentionally break the stems on those wood ferns. Do they need that hinge to be able to do what they do in the spring? Does that slow down their springtime development? Doing a few studies with trout lily, looking at how it moves around underground. At some point, I want to look at how long they, if they actually get younger as they make a new corm down at the bottom there. I've got a longer-term study looking at snow depth and the temperature of the air, snow, and the soil to see how that's going to affect things that are living underneath there. And largely just doing a lot of things that get at all the stuff that we don't know about our species. You know, E.O. Wilson from Harvard is kind of famous for saying that there's so much that we don't know even about our most common species. So I'm trying to fill in some of those natural history gaps about, you know, the species that we have out in the woods all the time. The little guys, the little beautiful ones that make up the bulk of the diversity in our forests that most of the time we're stepping over or on when we're thinking about the trees that are the dominance of the biomass.
Well, Jack, thanks so much for coming on tonight and taking the time to speak with us. And that's all I got on From the Forest.
Thanks for coming on. It was a lot of fun talking to you tonight.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
From the forest, his tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest.
WIOX is supported by Margaretville Hospital, a member of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, a critical access hospital offering comprehensive medical services, including emergency, cardiology, imaging, rehab, and a retail pharmacy. 845-586-1800.
Hi, I'm Glenn Peterson. I host Cabaret Corner, where we listen to the great American song.